including three children. That strike risked further escalation along the Israeli-Lebanon border, where Israel's military has already exchanged fire with the militant group Hezbollah. Lebanon's acting prime minister called the strike a, quote, heinous crime, and pledged to file a complaint with the UN Security Council. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 65 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 56 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
The time now is 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Here's some advice for you, friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man!
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone. They got a whole lot of police cars with their lights all flashing red.
Yes, a whole lot of police cars, indeed. That's Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges, alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. And before that, the unmistakable voice of Humphrey Bogart playing the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer, there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins, and of course, that's where I got the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. So for years, I've been running into people who tell me how the only reason they got into the journalism business was because of the help they got from a veteran newsman who taught for decades at Brooklyn College. The teacher's name is Anthony Mancini, and he spent some 40 years teaching and leading the journalism program at that school. And that stretch came after a couple of decades, about 20 years as a reporter at one of the city's greatest newspapers, the New York Post. Okay, not that New York Post. Not the Murdoch-ruled paper that's usually more interested in race-baiting and right-wing drivel than providing the news. No, I'm talking about the New York Post of old, the avowedly liberal newspaper that got upended by the media tycoon Murdoch in the mid-70s and turned into its opposite, an emblem of right-wing rage. Back then, Tony Mancini voted with his feet. He quit that paper after Murdoch took over. But he went on to a fine second career as a teacher, and it's fair to say, I think, that Tony Mancini has probably launched enough careers to fill several good-sized newsrooms, the kind we don't have enough of anymore. And it's because of the admiration of his former students that prompted me to ask Mr. Mancini to be on the show this evening. I got a note from Bill Hughes, a terrific young reporter whose work I much admire, and Bill suggested I have his legendary former journalism teacher on the show. My first reaction was, oh, why didn't I think of that? Pretty good idea. Tony Mancini's kind of a legend, both for his decades as a newspaper reporter and his decades more at Brooklyn College. You know, the journalism business likes to give out a lot of awards, you know, a lot of them pretty not worth a whole lot. They're named after publishers. But there's one that's really great. It's named after a real reporter. It's called the Peter Keese Award. And Back in 2017, they gave it to Tony Mancini. And at that event, one of the things they read out was some comment by Glenn Thrush, the Times reporter, a guy I first met when he was at City Limits magazine, who told Clyde Haberman in a piece about Tony Mancini when he got that award, "Without Tony, I wouldn't be in this business." Another good reason to have Tony Mancini on the show is that he just published his eighth novel. He started writing books back in the late 70s, I guess, and has been at it ever since. His new novel is called Ashes. And even though it takes place in the late 1940s in Italy, it's a pretty timely book about an issue that's a whole lot more prominent today, probably, than it was back then. We'll talk to him later about that. But first, Tony Mancini, welcome to WBAI.
Well, thanks, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure.
I love your intro. because that's one of the movies I used to show to a class I taught called The History of Present America. You know, to get their dander up about journalism. And it's a chestnut, and it's corny, but it still makes the hairs on my arm stand up, I have to say, that last scene.
You and me both.
Yeah.
I'd like to take that course.
Remember playing the gangster, Martin Gable? He was the actor playing the gangster. And he was married to Arlene Francis,
uh-huh,
who was on What's My Line.
Sure.
So we go back a long way.
We're right in the sweet spot of like old-time journalism. I love it. So before we start gabbing about reporting and teaching and novels and all that stuff, would you mind, Tony Mancini, filling us in a little on your background? I know you're a native New Yorker from the Bronx, is that right?
Yep, that's right. I was born an identical twin to Italian immigrants, actually, in the Bronx. And I was actually born in Manhattan because the hospital was Cabrini, which doesn't exist anymore.
Right, another one gone.
But we were based in the Bronx. That was in the neighborhood best known now as the Arthur Avenue, a mecca of Italian Americans in the Bronx. Right. But we didn't take long. I was 2 years old when we moved to the Northeast Bronx.
Yeah, were your folks immigrants? What did they do?
Well, yeah, they were immigrants. My mother was obviously, in those days, what we used to call a housewife.
Uh-huh.
And my father was, a practically illiterate immigrant. He could read English and Italian, but he taught himself how to read. And he was a construction laborer who ultimately worked on the Holland Tunnel, the Long Island Expressway, and he later became the gang foreman, and a member of the Carpenters Union.
Good.
It's a really strictly working class background that
good
I come
you.
From.
So was there a connection there to writing of any sort?
Absolutely not.
What was that?
Not that I know of, anyhow.
Well, were there papers in the house? Were they bringing home the news or the journal or something?
The newspapers were in the house, yes. But mostly, I think it was at that time, the Daily News, maybe the Mirror, too, which was a working class newspaper, both of them.
Right.
But I didn't think about newspapering very much until later. But I did think about being a scribbler. I remember when I was about five, before entering grade school, my cousin, who was a lot older than me, she gave me a copy of Treasure Island.
Uh-huh.
And I read that, and somehow the seed was planted, I think.
That's all it takes is a great story. That's terrific.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
Stories have been, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, telling stories has been my life.
Yeah, and a good life it's been. So I know that a lot of reporters started out as copy boys, but I don't think anybody has the story that you've got. Share it with us. You told me a little bit about it the other day.
As I said, I was born an identical twin, and my brother Joe also has a long career as a journalist. Mm-hmm. And I were a student at Fordham College when we were 19 years old, and a friend of ours, another student, told us that there was an opening for a night copy boy position at the New York Post when it was located on 75 West Street, which goes back to 1958, I'm talking about. So don't fall off your chair. You'll be able to do the math and know how old I am. They said there was an opening for a full-time position at the Lobster Trick, which in those days meant 1 to 8 in the morning. And that was overnight. Now, we were full-time students. We had a full load, and we didn't think we could take the job unless we shared it. So we decided to show up. One of us would show up one night, and the other would show up the other night. We didn't tell anybody that we were two people. Nobody asked. And ultimately, as long as we showed up, and we nobody cared.
Who got the job, Joe or Tony?
Who was first?
Well, you only told them one name, right? So was it Joe or Tony?
No, well, we didn't. I don't really remember that fact.
That's an important one.
I don't know how we finessed that, but we did.
All right.
That's the truth.
Well, it was a pretty good trick. Did you get found out? You got found out eventually. Come on, somebody.
As I told you, I think it was kind of a very informal thing. We would finish our tricks. In other words, it makes me sound like a prostitute. We would finish our...
It's an old newspaper term. It's okay. You did your trick. All right.
And we would go to the city editor, who at that time was Johnny Bott. He's probably lost to memory. And get a voucher and go straight downstairs to payroll and get our money in a little envelope in cash. So we weren't strictly staff members until later, but we were what they called casual employees.
Uh-huh.
So we weren't really playing the system all that much.
Okay, all right. You got paid per shift. That's fair enough.
We got paid per shift, right. And it was just the money we could use for spending money.
Right. And you kept going to school at the same time.
Right. Hmm. And then when we got our degrees, we even before that, I think, we were promoted to editorial clerks. And I spent a stint pretty soon in the Army, 2 years as a draftee.
Hmm.
Came back and was promised a job, and because that was the law. And I continued my career.
So it was at some point, Tony Mancini, you got bit by the bug. Do you remember what it was?
Well, sure. I'll tell you, the atmosphere in the Post at 75 West Street and later on at 210 South Street, which was the building that the Journal American abandoned.
Right down there between the bridges, right on the river.
And Mrs. Schiff, our owner, decided she wanted to buy it. So the atmosphere was what you would think of if you ever saw the movie, if you ever saw any of the movies that romanticized the era of...
The front page.
Kind of grubby newsrooms. My Girl Friday and any of those movies.
Right.
It was a truly Runyon-esque atmosphere. We even at the old place had pneumatic tubes where people would send the copy in the tube and it would be whooshed to the composing room.
Great sound background to that, to the pneumatic
tubes. We had hot type, we had linotype machines, we had the clacking of the mechanical typewriters. This was in the late 50s, remember?
Right.
And we also had smoke filled the air, that's for sure. Everyone, the ashes on the keyboards.
Right.
The people, no personal trainers in those days. Everybody, not everybody, I'm exaggerating, but lots of people had the whiskey in the top drawer. No question about that.
Okay, hold on one second. This is WBAI 99.5 FM, folks. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. I'm talking to Anthony Mancini, reporter, teacher, and novelist. And we're talking right now about his days at the old New York Post, the pre-Rupert Murdoch Post. The Post was famous, Tony Mancini, for its columnists or something.
Yeah,
guys like James Wexler, Max Lerner.
Right.
Did you get a chance to rub up against those folks?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. All of them. Murray Kempton.
Tell us about Murray Kempton.
He would cover... He didn't write his columns from the ivory tower.
Yeah.
He would go to the courthouses with all of us and cover the story. Right. In order to get the kind of juice that he needed to write a compelling column. Pete Hamill was one of my colleagues for many years. Mary McGrory was at the Washington Post, but we ran her column by syndication. It had a section called a magazine section every day in the paper.
Right.
And that's where the opinion columns appeared.
Writing was really a strong part of the paper, right? They wanted writers.
It was a very strong part of the paper. And they also encouraged good writing in the news sections as long as you stuck to the facts. I mean, the thing is, back then, even in a tabloid, which didn't shy away from sensational stories in the sense that there was a lot of mayhem and celebrity gossip and all that stuff that people think of when they think of a tabloid, but it was done in a what I think still today was a way that was ethical. Sure, maybe Earl Wilson would drop a tidbit or two that he didn't double check, but who didn't, you know?
Tony Mancini, what was your beat? You were general assignment?
I had one beat, and that was the United Nations that I covered for a year once. Uh-huh. And I learned a lot there, obviously. But I was a general assignment reporter.
GA.
And that suited me fine, because it was an adventure every day.
Tell us what that means. What is being a
general assignment
reporter?
Means you call up the city room. If you didn't have a story working yourself or anything that you'd call up the city room every day from your home, it was remote work, and the city editor or the assistant city editor will say, "Hey, Tony, there's a fire in Brooklyn. Get there as soon as you can by subway." how we got there, and you know, cover it. Or I'd say, I want you to do an interview with Chief Adebo of Nigeria. He's at the consulship on the Upper West East Side. Go sit down with him and bring back some kind of a feature. You never knew what you were going to do. And I never had so much fun in my life. I must say, I've been lucky enough to have a number of very good jobs that I kind of fell into, but the one that I remember most fondly is my time at the New York Post.
Sure,
and maybe that's because I was so young. But we had a wonderful atmosphere, camaraderie, etc. Until
Let me ask you, we'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah.
Dark days. But let me ask you just a couple more questions about the craft itself.
Yeah.
Were you mostly calling in your stories to rewrite, or you going back and picking them out yourself?
Lots of people who did that. Mike Pearl, but lots of people who never wrote a story, who were called leg men.
Okay.
And then there were rewrite men. But I did both. I worked as a writer. I worked on rewrite. I mean, I could craft a story. I always could, and I always did, mostly.
And where did that come from, Tony? You say you could always craft a story.
I think it came from my Jesuit education.
Jesuit?
Yeah.
Make the connection there for folks. I don't know if I
quite follow. Well, I had a Catholic school education from start to finish.
Okay.
Holy Rosary Grammar School, Regis High School, which is a Jesuit institution, and Fordham College. They teach you the fundamentals in those places. They teach you grammar and syntax. We had to parse, the nuns had us parse sentences. Nobody does that anymore.
Okay.
In the second, third, and fourth grades.
And that led you to being able to put together a story on deadline at the New York Post.
Well, you know, it was hard at first, but, you know, I have to say we just had the knack for it. Joe was quicker than I was at first.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. I would agonize a little more. But, you know, when you're forced to produce in an hour or two, you're lucky enough to get that much time.
Yeah.
You find a way,
right?
If you're resourceful enough, and you learn by your mistakes.
Right. Sometimes you're doing it in a pretty noisy newsroom.
Noisy, I'll say. but I love the noise.
Sort of get your mind over chatter, right?
Exactly right. Well, you probably remember your own experiences there. But you know, I never worked on computers. By the time I left, by the time Murdoch took over, all we had was not mechanical, but electric typewriters, and that was a big transition for me. They were noisy. People yelling, copy. People smoking. It was cracked up to be.
Okay. Let me ask you one more question before we get to the dark days here. Pete Hamill, you mentioned this guy a moment ago, but Pete Hamill used to talk about Paul Sann, S-A-N-N, a lot, as being the greatest tabloid editor of his career. And he said that Sann used to say, if you've got the story, tell it. If you don't have the story, write it.
Yes.
Translate that to us? What is he talking about?
Well, he's talking about that. I don't think he. If you can bring a little bit of panache to the story, it might make up for a lack of facts.
Uh-huh.
I think that's what he meant by it.
Okay.
I don't think Paul himself would do that.
Well, tell us about Paul Sann. Who was he, and why was
Paul
he Sann get
was
these accolades?
He was a Runyon-esque character. He was something I never, a kid from the Bronx, had never seen before. He was it was like a guy who was invented by Ben Hecht. he was like me in many ways.
Huh.
He was a immigrant's son from the Bronx, just happened to be Jewish instead of Italian.
Uh-huh.
He didn't have the benefit of the good education I got, virtue of the Catholic Church, because he quit school and went to work for the Post as a copy boy, just as I did, and then worked his way up the ladder.
What made him so great?
Paul. He was a true editor in the sense that he came in early in the morning and read every line of everybody else's stories.
Mm, hard work.
And he seemed to be on the outside, like the typical cynical newsman, but he really had a soft center. And he was good enough to send you a memo if you wrote a good story. And I never remember him doing the opposite.
That's good.
Castigating you. He had a typical it was a yellow memo that would be inter-office mail, and his P for Paul. He put a little face in the circle that goes in the P.
How cute!
And he put two symbols, two little dashes over the U, and it was always the same. So it was very. It was a very happy thing. That's when nice.
So those are the glory days. All right.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So let's shift gears now. What is it, 1975? What year does Rupert Murdoch buy the paper?
Yeah, 76. I have a photo.
You call it a dark day in New York journalism. Well, did it seem that way right away?
No, I call it a dark day in American journalism.
Oh, in American journalism.
Yeah, when I look at, think about it, Tom. When I look at the state of journalism now, which I deplore, there are two things that I credit with it being so bad. It's the internet, which has done a lot of good, but more likely a lot of bad, and the arrival of Rupert Murdoch,
those two. Well, let me ask you something. Hold on a second. There's a lot of things we don't like, but let me tell you. Did it seem right away that Murdoch was going to take the paper in the direction he did, or did it take a while to see how he was shaping the paper?
It didn't take long at all. I remember him. There's a photo of me that I have somewhere. Not me alone. Murdoch is standing on one side of the newsroom. There's a whole clutch of people standing around him. And I'm directly opposite him, looking at him skeptically. And he's telling us, I remember, nothing is going to change. Well, that was a bunch of horse manure, we found out very quick.
Send me that picture. I want to see that picture.
Yeah, I will send it to you.
Was the staff buying this? What was the overall reaction of the staff at the time?
The staff, most of us fled. A lot of us did.
Why?
Why? Because if we wrote a story that didn't fit the template that they already had for it, we wouldn't be told to change it or do something.
Well, put some meat on those bones. Did you actually have stories that were editors all of a sudden were saying, we don't like the way this reads, and it was all...
No, they would just put it on the spike. They wouldn't even tell you about it.
They would spike the story.
Spike the story.
Uh-huh.
And so then you got the message. Uh-huh. I remember also the treatment that he gave Ed Koch in the election against Cuomo for mayor.
Right.
Every story, he had five or six stories up front about how great Koch was, and nothing about Cuomo. He was so blatantly pushing for one candidate. In the news, I'm talking about in the news section.
Okay, just hold on. Let me just ask you a question. You mentioned before Dorothy Schiff. They called her Dolly, I guess. Didn't she play favorites among the politicians as well?
Yeah. Not so blatantly, let's put it that way.
Okay.
I can't, she would never, and her editors would not let her.
Uh-huh.
There would be a rebellion in the newsroom if she tried to behave the way Murdoch did.
Hmm.
We've had several rebellions while I was there.
Why do you think Rupert Murdoch wanted the New York Post? Was it to make money?
It was on trade. He didn't make money. He lost money every year. It was his entree, and he got two newspapers in San Antonio, Texas at the same time, if you recall.
Okay.
He wanted to get into this market. He knew what he was about to do, and that is to destroy American journalism.
Well,
I'm sorry. I have no middle ground with him.
That's okay. I just want people to understand what the impact was. Wasn't there a petition at some point that the staff circulated?
Well, that was a petition. This was before Murdoch. I think what you're talking to about is...
I thought it was during the campaign you were just talking about.
Story objecting to our byline because it was a profile of a woman, and the only reason they were doing it is because she was married to a famous man. So she said, I'll write the story, but I don't want my byline on it. And unfortunately, the union contract gave her that right, so we all backed her up on that.
Good for you. Good for you.
That was before Murdoch. Right. After Murdoch, we had a lot of problems with him, but I don't remember.
Did the readership change? I mean, you were going along as a pretty liberal newspaper reporting the news, and then it changed. Was it your sense of the readership? Were there different people reading the paper? Do you have any sense of that?
I didn't have any. I mean, at first, it was hard to tell because we didn't, you know, as a reporter, you wouldn't be getting those numbers.
No, but you would talk to people. You know, you'd hear from family, you'd hear from friends. You'd pick up the
people,
buzz.
They always said, "What happened to the New York Post?" is what they would say.
What happened to the New York Post?
Everybody kind of knew because they knew when Murdoch was there.
Could the old Post have survived?
You know, that's a good question. Not if it lost as much money as the Murdochs did. But one never knows if somebody else took it over. Mrs. Schiff was told by Murdoch, one of the conditions was that she would be kept on as a consultant. And so she believed him. And she had this little area upstairs on the top floor where she had her office. And it was like Betty Davis rattling around in the attic. He never paid any attention to her until she got the picture and finally gave up.
All right. We're going to take a short break here. We're going to hear a little bit of music, and then we'll be back with Anthony Mancini, more tales of the journalism business, and we'll talk about the 8 novels he's written. Reggie, we got that tune lined up here?
See you later.
The great Dexter Gordon playing Autumn in New York. Just a sweet little tune to mark the season. I'm back. This is Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. We're here on WBAI 99.5 FM. The rent is due here at a studio on Atlantic Avenue, and I hope folks will pitch in and help us raise some shekels to be able to pay the landlord. If you got $5, $10, $20, you can shovel something our way. The number is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And think about maybe becoming what they call a BAI buddy of this show, making a regular contribution to keep us going. 212-209-2950. Anthony Mancini, so when did you start writing novels? You were still at the Post, right?
Well, yeah. I always had this idea that I would write some novels. And in the early 70s, let me see if I get the times right. In any case, at one point, when I was married to my first wife, Pat McNeese, we were having trouble getting pregnant, so I took a leave of absence. In order to get this leave, I had to go up and pay obeisance to the lady upstairs, Dolly Schiff.
Mm-hmm.
And she invited me to tea to talk about it.
That's nice. Take you to
tea. I told her the reason she wanted to know, and she looked like she smelled a rat and said, "Why would anybody want to have children that bad?" She did say that, basically. She had two children of her own. Three husbands, but still she wasn't all that keen on motherhood. In any case, we went to Europe, my then wife and I. We had that baby.
All right.
As a matter of fact, she was already in the oven when we were on the freight of going over.
Mazel tov.
And I wrote my first novel, Mini Santangelo's Mortal Sin.
Okay, that's a great title. Let me just stop you right there, because I looked these up, and there's a wonderful list of your name. Mini Santangelo's Mortal Sin. Is it giving away too much if we ask you, what was that mortal sin?
No, I don't. The book is long. You can get it on Amazon, but it's too far. It's considered now, by some sellers, a classic. That's how old it is. And that's how old I am.
Okay. Well, you are a classic. I like that. Okay. Well, what was the book? What got you going for that first one?
It was kind of billed as a housewife in Little Italy, Minnie Santangelo,
mm-hmm.
who was like a kind of a homey Miss Marple. That's what they've envisioned it as, a kind of a series. I thought I was going to heaven when that book was published, because it was my first time I ever showed a novel, and it got immediate interest.
Uh-huh.
And Coward McGann and Gehagen, a respected publishing sure. house, mainstream publishing house, sure. was interested right away with a few rewrites. And it did quite well, because it sold a lot of foreign rights, and even better, it was a Reader's Digest condensed book selection.
Oh, there you go.
Now in those days, and you know, that was a nice piece of change for me.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, where book clubs were really important, no longer now. The book clubs that are important are Oprah and all those people, and they're not really book clubs. They're sort of promoters of the book. They don't publish at all. But so I got, on the basis of a one-page treatment, a contract for the second Mini Santangelo book.
Uh-huh.
Mini Santangelo and the Mortal Sin. I'm sorry, Mini Santangelo and the Evil Eye.
The Evil Eye. There's an Italian phrase that describes the Evil Eye.
But that didn't do so well.
Malocchio, right?
It did okay, but and it had and we had it had a foreign rights too, but it didn't get me onto Miss Marple's or okay. Agatha Christie's trail. So
Tony Mancini, would you call these mysteries, crime thrillers?
Yeah.
What were they?
Yeah. They were mysteries, kind of cozy mysteries.
Cozy mysteries.
I chose the genre
uh-huh.
because I thought it would teach me structure.
Uh-huh.
Because mysteries follow a certain pattern. And so that was my way of breaking into.
Were you a big reader yourself of mysteries?
I was a big reader, period.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I really learned how to write.
Uh-huh.
I learned how to write by pinching effects, as Lawrence Durrell said. In other words, stealing from other great writers.
Only steal from the best. That's the first rule.
That's
you're
exactly
going to steal.
Right. So you got to be a little bit of a thief. But you don't really plagiarize. What you do is you study the techniques.
How they did it.
And right. I read the classics from top to bottom.
Uh-huh.
I read popular books.
Uh-huh.
I became, and still am, obviously, a big reader. And that's what I tell my students. You want to write? Read.
Read. Read and
pinch effects.
And was there's another one with a wonderful title. the Miracle of Pelham Park.
The Miracle of Pelham Bay Park.
It was a kind of a
fable about a 12-year-old girl in the Bronx who claims to have had a vision of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and then the troubles she had with various clergy in getting believed.
Uh-huh.
And so
you were sort of shifting gears at this point. This was not a mystery story.
I wanted to try everything.
Uh-huh.
I was bored by Mini Sant'Angelo anyhow. I had no, but the well had gone dry with that. I was still trying to figure out how to do this stuff.
Right.
And the only way to do that is to try other things.
Okay. Well, can I ask you what the miracle was of Pelham Bay Park?
The miracle of Pelham Bay Park was her seeing the Virgin.
Uh-huh.
But the real miracle is life itself.
Okay. Okay.
To put it in as pithy a fashion as possible.
Uh-huh.
Actually, the book was well received. You remember Madeline L'Engle who wrote the
Wrinkle in Time?
She gave it a wonderful blurb.
Praise from the highest level. That's impressive.
Yes.
Was that? Do you? I mean, I guess I shouldn't. If I ask you your favorite, you're going to say the one you just published. But it sounds like you had fun with the Miracle of Pelham Bay Park.
I'll give you the answer that I always give.
Yeah.
I hate them all.
You hate them all. Why do you hate them all?
Because they're all failures in a sense.
Oh.
Because they never came up to my expectations. Now I'm being a little hard on myself, but that's exactly what I feel after. I finally learned that you end the book. People say, when did you start writing this book? And I always say, when I was born. and, you know, I mean that not facetiously at all.
Yeah.
When you start, things germinate in ways that, you don't want to really examine too closely because you'll break the spell. But you don't, all books that any writer, any fiction writer writes, germinated over the years.
Right.
So,
but sometimes you have these ideas in your head and they're pretty tough to translate them onto paper.
Well, I was very grateful to my apprenticeship as a news writer, and not because we told lies or made up stories. But because, first of all, it taught you to meet deadlines and not dither and dally, because you could always make something better to get the good instead of the perfect and go on.
Mm.
But and also it taught me how to write a clear sentence, and also not to send messages, not try to. Now, someone once asked me, "Why do you write? Do you think you have something to say?" I said, "No, I write books because I have something to make." When you write a book, you're making something that didn't exist before. You're not going to say anything new; it's all been said before. So that's the message I have. For anyone who wants to write the book that it's in you to write and follow whatever inspirations you have.
Did you find it fairly easy to write these books? Did they roll out of your typewriter or were they struggles?
You know what Marilyn L'Engle said once about that? Writing is easy. You sit in front of the typewriter and you wait for the beads of blood to form on your forehead. I mean, no, it never was easy. I must say, I don't have writer's block anymore. As the years roll on, I know what my strengths are, and I know what my weaknesses are, so there's no point in having writer's block. Put down what occurs to you to write and edit it. You know, I write in a very lapidary way. I don't rewrite. I rewrite as I go along. It's like, and this comes from the journalism. you edit as you go. I edit as I go along, like a sculptor. That's what I mean by lapidary. Hmm. I keep sculpting sentences and sculpting paragraphs.
Hmm.
And so I don't have writer's block. That doesn't mean I'm a great writer.
I like that image, sculpting sentences and paragraphs as you go along.
Yeah.
Folks, this is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. I'm talking this evening with Anthony Mancini, a legendary reporter, journalism professor, and novelist. And we're at the novelist section at the moment. You want to tell us about your new, most latest book, Ashes? It's an elderly priest. He goes to a town in Sicily, and he has to wrestle with his own demons. Where did that come from?
Well, that's a good question. Where did it come from? Well, I started thinking about, the current scandals about clerical abuse. And I know there's a lot of creeps out there. Not that I was ever...
Did you encounter creeps when you were a kid?
I did.
You said you went through...
I have to say, and then I started to say, why? Why wasn't I? Am I not attractive enough? I think I know why.
Did your friends, did Joe, did anybody else that you know?
Joe and I were always together.
Mm.
So who's going to...
So nobody that you knew of ever experienced this in your entire youth?
No one did. I have to say, no one who revealed that to me.
All right.
So, but I don't. I understand. I know, I know why a lot of priests, a lot of people like that go to the priesthood. Because they're trying to escape sexuality. They know they come usually from very strong Catholic backgrounds, and they know that the tendencies that they have and the proclivities that they feel are sinful. And the only way, the first way they want to get rid of it, that's not to say everybody does this. The only way they can deal with it is to be celibate. Push sexuality aside.
Is this your character that you're talking about?
What's that?
Is this your character in Ashes that you're describing right now?
In a way it is, yes.
Okay, all right. Yeah. And tell us a little bit about him, just so...
Well, all right, he's a German priest who had a fondness for a young man when he was a young man, a boy, actually. And... that ended badly, and he decided to become a priest. And for the reasons, I don't think he knew what these feelings were all about at first, but he realized over the years that he had a sexual attraction, not for children, but for boys. And there must be a distinction made between those two, because they're on a different level entirely.
Mm. No, the law doesn't make a distinction, but go ahead.
I know the law doesn't, but right. I do.
Okay, all right.
Because you can be attracted, just like I can be, as a heterosexual, can be attracted to a teenage female. I mean, after all, for millennia, as soon as a woman became fecund, she was married off. I mean, it's just a natural thing. It's acting on it that's wrong, okay? Yeah. And having a sexual attraction for children, prepubescent people, that's outrageous.
He's elderly, right? Your German priest who goes
to... Yeah, he's 69
years old. Taormina, Sicily. Let me ask you about Sicily for a minute. There's a lot of beautiful description. Did you spend a lot of time in Sicily?
Well, I did spend a couple of... sessions, and I was at Taormina many years ago, and when I got the idea of doing this, we went back for me to take notes and kind of drink in the background. But I've been writing about Italians and Italian Americans most of my career. So,
this guy's a German. This guy's a German in Italy.
He's a German. Yeah, I lived in Germany for a year.
Was that when you were in the service?
No, I was in the service at Columbus, Georgia, but I worked for a newspaper called the Overseas Weekly, which no one has heard of anymore. It was the distaff version of Stars and Stripes. In other words, Stars and Stripes was the official paper for the GIs. The Overseas Weekly was the underground paper for the GIs.
Uh-huh. Underground newspaper.
Kind of like, in a way, you know, from the Village Voice, let's say. So I worked for them for a little while. That's when I lived in Germany, and I studied Germany. I'm sorry, the language in high school.
Was this idea about profiling? I mean, this takes place in a very different time zone. I think, is it 1949 when he's arrived?
1949, yeah.
In Taormina?
I don't like to write about modern times.
All right, okay.
I don't feel comfortable.
Okay. So, but you purposely placed it in an era in which this kind of thing was not talked about at all. I mean, there were no revelations about clerical abuse at that
That's
point.
That's right. That's correct.
And was that part of your goal, was to be able to sort of portray?
I think so. But I don't, as I said before, I don't examine it too closely.
Uh-huh. Did you like your character? Did you like the priest?
I liked him.
Uh-huh. Tell us why you liked him. What was
He was a tortured person who did his best.
Mm-hmm.
And what's not to like?
Okay. All right. Was he a good priest?
He was a good priest, yep. I mean, he was not like a holier than thou. He was very tolerant and broad-minded.
Hmm.
But, you know, that's him, not me.
Okay.
I kind of opened the door and he was standing there.
All right.
I let my characters lead me.
Okay.
And then the minor characters that go through this story were also like ghostly figures in the background when I started thinking about this book. So at date, I don't know how I do these things, Tom. I have to, you know, after I finish, I said, did I write that? Did I say that? Where was I at the time?
Well, I guess
I'm not trying to be too mystical about this, but what I'm saying comes from a true place. I'm telling you the truth.
And you say that you don't like most of your books. Do you feel okay about this one at this point,
Tony
Mancini?
No, I was being a little facetious.
Okay,
then.
Good.
But that's the answer I give people.
All right.
I like this one, yes. Right.
And if folks wanted to read Ashes by Anthony Mancini, it's published by, say the name of the publisher, I didn't write it down.
It's Tolmitch.
Tolmitch.
Tolmitch Press.
Okay.
That's Tolmitch. It's a small press. I couldn't get anyone but a small press interested in me after all these years.
Small presses count.
They're good.
And the title is intriguing. Ashes. Tell us what the title is. It has a couple of different meanings.
Yeah. I always think good titles are relevant on two levels, on the material level and on the symbolic level. Now, Ashes is obvious because brooding in the background of this story is the volcano Etna.
Mount Etna.
Which in 1949, I try to keep all the surrounding details true to the history. In that year, and that's one of the reasons I picked 1949, there were two eruptions of the volcano in the time that I set
the story.
So
there's Mount Etna, and what's the other one? We're going to wrap up in about less than a minute.
Okay, well, Etna, the ashes are material. The symbolic, the symbolism, obviously, is the rue, the ashes of a life that he feels might have been wasted on the priesthood.
Well, it's a good read. I got it before the show, and I commend it to people's attention. Let me ask
you
Anthony Mancini, in the last few moments we've got here, do you give pearls of wisdom to your students that you think sort of encapsulate it all in terms of like how to just get the job done? You got 45 seconds if you got
one. Okay, now you got the I told my students, put news in the past tense.
Put news in the past tense.
Because all news is past.
All news is past.
And that also encourages them to see it as events rather than ideas.
There you go. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Anthony Mancini, reporter extraordinaire, teacher, novelist, author of Ashes. Thanks, Reggie Johnson, for engineering. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll let Eddie Lockjaw Davis steal the last few moments of this show with Oliver Nelson's Stolen Moment. Take care, everyone.
With these headlines. Protesters in Oakland, California delayed the sailing of an alleged arms shipment to Israel for hours today by locking themselves to the vessel. Protesters claim the ship is on its way to be loaded with weapons in Tacoma, Washington. Organized by a San Francisco Muslim group, several Jewish activists joined the protest. In related news, over the weekend, hundreds of thousands of pro-Palestinian demonstrators gathered in cities around the globe, including Washington, D.C. Massive crowds also gathered in London. The protests come as the death toll from Israeli bombardment of Gaza surpassed 10,000. Nearly half of the dead are children. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres launched a campaign today to raise $1.2 billion in humanitarian aid for Gaza. He says the carnage is unprecedented.
Gaza is becoming a graveyard for children. Hundreds of girls and boys are reportedly being killed or injured every day. More journalists have reportedly been killed over a four-week period than in any conflict in at least three decades. More United Nations aid workers have been killed than in any comparable period in the history of our organization.
In Washington, political differences are threatening to divide Democrats going into a presidential election year. Michigan Representative Rashid Tlaib released a video directly attacking President Joe Biden over the issue, a rare rebuke to a president by a young member of his own party. It opens with a statement by Biden and footage of the destruction in Gaza.
We stand with Israel.
Mr. President, the American people are not with you on this one.
Innocent civilians are going to be hurt.
We will remember in 2024.
Tlaib has been the target of attack ads by pro-Israel Democrats. In one ad, she's hit below the belt by a reporter.
And she refuses to answer even this horrific question.
You can't comment about Hamas terrorists chopping off baby pets.
Tell Rashida Tlaib she's on the wrong side of history and humanity.
Meanwhile, anti-war Americans are gearing up for a long battle to stop the Gaza conflict that shows no sign of an early end. Activist Brad Wolf is with a group organizing the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal. Witnesses will present evidence to a jury of alleged war crimes by the United States and Israel.
We hope that they will find these United States corporations and the CEOs of the corporations guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Opening session of the tribunal convenes later this week.
The tribunal will be this Sunday evening, November 12th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. It's going to be live streamed and it is free. You go to www.merchantsofdeath.org to register.
The tribunal is modeled on similar tribunals that expose U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. And a Republican is in an uphill battle to steal the GOP presidential nomination from former President Donald Trump. His name is Vivek Ramaswamy. Ramaswamy says the United States is locked in an internal war over individual rights.
Either you believe in free speech or you believe in censorship. You cannot have both. Either you believe in American exceptionalism or you believe in American apologism.
But writer and educator Arun Kunani says the threat against freedom of speech is not from woke liberals, but from supporters of Israel who have been overtly trying to silence dissent.
Because they're losing the argument on the pro-Israel side, they're increasingly resorting to censorship. And so we're seeing very large numbers of people who are having job offers rescinded, pressure on universities to clamp down on pro-Palestinian activism, non-violent